including the one that Carl Taylor was in at Sullivan Correctional Facility. And there are lots of caring doctors and nurses and psychologists who were there. I think the problem essentially is they're still in a correctional environment, which are like, these are like being in the army. It's military rules, you know. I mean, I had a great quote from Brian Fisher, who's the former commissioner of corrections for New York State, who said, what do we do with an inmate who is getting an order from a guard at the same time he's getting an order from the voice in his head? Which voice is he going to listen to? Carl Taylor clearly listened to the voice in his head, and a tragedy resulted.
Why is Carl Taylor dead? That is the name, the title of the piece subtitled Our Prisons Are Our Mental Wards. Tom Robbins, contributing writer with the Marshall Project, investigative journalist in residence at the Graduate School of Journalism at CUNY.
And congrats on your award from
City Limits recently for your investigative journalism.
Thank you, Juan.
If you can stay, we want to just continue to ask you about the kind of changes that are being talked about in the New York State and countrywide in prisons. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening. This is KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland's Saturday Market. 45 years of handmade arts and crafts, fresh food, and local music. Open every Saturday and Sunday through Christmas Eve at Waterfront Park in downtown Portland. Open daily from December 19th through 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Event schedule, vendor information, and more online at portlandsaturdaymarket.com. And now it's time for the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Portland man attempted to bribe an ICE agent to deport his wife, and a new UN environmental report warns that the world is not doing enough to stop climate change. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 27th, 2018. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. A Portland man has pleaded guilty to attempting to bribe a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent to deport his estranged wife and her child. 48-year-old Antonio Burgos followed an ICE officer from the facility in Portland to a Vancouver parking lot. He then offered the agent money to deport his wife. Burgos explained that he was in the process of divorcing the woman. He had sponsored her residency in the U.S., but now that they were separating, he wanted her out. The officer declined the bribe and reported it to the Office of Professional Responsibility. The office contacted Burgos on a recorded call. He offered them $3,000 to deport his wife. Burgos was then arrested and has pleaded guilty to a bribery charge. He will be sentenced on May 6th of next year. Black History 365 celebrates Black achievements and honors moments in Black history for each day of the year.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is November 27th. On this day in 1841, the liberators of the ship Amistad set sail for 7 weeks back to Africa after the captured Africans were imprisoned in America and later set free. Before being set free, the captured Africans aboard the Amistad decided to rebel in March of 1839, which led them from accidentally traveling north from Cuba to New York instead of east.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
A Portland area pharmacist has been accused of secretly recording people at his work. 34-year-old Johnny Tuck Chi Chan was arrested and booked into the Multnomah County Jail following a year-long investigation. He has pleaded not guilty to charges of encouraging child sex abuse and invasion of personal privacy. Chan is a licensed pharmacist with Kaiser Permanente at their Airport Way Center Pharmacy Supply and Laboratory. Prosecutors argue that Chen used secret cameras to record people, including children, in a bathroom at his work. According to court documents, the recordings took place between December 1st of 2016 and November 14th of 2017. Chan's next scheduled court appearance is January 14th of next year. And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1910. That was the day when thousands of people came to see the location where a fire had ravaged a sweatshop in Newark, New Jersey. The day before, at least 26 women perished in the inferno. The workers of the Alfred and Irving Wolf Muslin Undergarment Company made nightgowns. On the morning of the fire, there were more than 100 women crowded into the fourth floor workspace. The fire broke out when a can of gasoline was knocked over in the lamp company located below the sweatshop. The floors of the garment shop were wooden and strewn with fabric. The fire spread quickly. It roared up so fast. Even though there was a fire station across the street, the fire crew could not get there in time. It would become the worst fire in Newark's history. Desperate women tried to escape, but the fire safety exits were not adequate. Some of the women leapt to their deaths from the fourth-story windows. The fire became national news. No one was ever held legally accountable for the conditions that led to the fire. Less than a year and a half later, tragedy would again strike the garment industry when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire would claim the lives of 146 workers. The events of the Newark fire faded into the annals of history. For years, no memorial marked the location. Richard Greenwald, a dean at a nearby university, thought that the women who died deserved to be remembered. As the 100th anniversary approached, he found the graves of 25 of the women and organized a memorial ceremony. He also helped to create a bronze plaque to remember the site. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Doctors are warning that if you attempt to quit drinking alcohol after a long period of heavy use, it may be wise to seek professional help. Alcohol is the most dangerous substance for the body to withdraw from, and it could lead to death if not under medical supervision. The National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism has said that there are around 16 million people in the U.S. that suffer from compulsive alcohol use. Withdrawal from alcohol could lead to delirium tremens, or DTs, which are characterized mostly by shaking, shivering, sweating, and confusion. For those people who experience them while going through withdrawal, the death rate has been estimated to be as high as 4%. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that in 2016 alone, there were 831 deaths related to alcohol withdrawal. And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, two Connecticut initiatives make solar power more affordable for state residents.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Going solar can provide lower energy bills, but the homeowners who need those savings the most are also the least likely to invest in solar energy. Carrie O'Neill ran residential energy programs at Connecticut Green Bank.
In the middle of 2014, our board asked us to take a look at how we were doing in terms of getting solar into low-income communities. And when we looked at the data, wow, we just were not doing a good job at all. We were really missing the mark.
So the bank launched two programs that are now run through Inclusive Prosperity Capital, a clean energy investment fund that was spun off from the bank. One program offers affordable leases for solar with no upfront cost. The other pays an incentive to solar contractors for installing systems for low and moderate income households, so companies can offer lower prices to these customers. The programs worked. Now homeowners making less than the state's median income install solar at the same rates as those with higher incomes.
We've closed the gap. Outside the state, everyone's like, how did you do that? That seems impossible. Well, it's actually not impossible, but you have to focus on it. You have to say, this is a goal and this is something we're trying to solve.
Commercial crabbers in Oregon and California are suing 30 fossil fuel companies. They claim that the fossil fuel companies are to blame for climate change, which is hurting their industry. The Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations filed the lawsuit last week in the California State Superior Court in San Francisco. They are suing 30 different companies, including Chevron and ExxonMobil. Noah Oppenheim, the executive director of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, told the San Francisco Chronicle, quote, "The scientific linkage between the combustion of fossil fuels and ocean warming, which leads to domoic acid impacts in our fisheries, is clear. We know it, and it's time to hold that industry accountable for the damage they've caused." Crab is the most valuable single-species commercial fishery in Oregon. In October of this year, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations successfully sued the U.S. Environmental Protection Association to protect salmon and steelhead trout populations in the Columbia River Basin from warm water temperatures caused by dams and climate change. Current Cast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, contaminated well water could put babies at risk.
Nitrates in rural wells. On this Current Cast. Nitrate is a natural chemical compound present in almost all water. But high levels in fertilizer runoff, septic discharges, or animal waste can leach into groundwater. If it gets into drinking water, it puts infants at risk for blue baby syndrome, a condition preventing them from getting enough oxygen. Brian Swistock of Penn State Extension says nitrate is not absorbed through the skin.
You can shower in the water.
But if levels are high, use bottled water for drinking and cooking. Nitrate has no smell or taste, so the only way to know if you have a problem is to have your well tested. Boiling does not help, so water treatment may be the only solution if you have nitrate in your water. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
A new United Nations report released today is warning that global efforts to tackle greenhouse gas emissions are behind schedule. Emissions have reached a record high of 53.5 billion tons as of 2017. This represents the first rise in emissions after 3 years of decreases. The ninth annual UN Environmental Program report analyzed the impact of climate policies implemented by individual countries. The report was released just a few days before the UN climate conference starts in Poland. The talks will hopefully result in a rulebook for how countries should implement the 2015 Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement aims to limit the rise of global temperatures to less than 2 degrees Celsius annually. According to the new report, global emissions will need to be around 25% lower than current levels by 2030 to limit global warming to 2 degrees. The emissions reductions increases to 55% in order to lower the rise of temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Next up, it's the Week in Water from H2O Radio. On today's episode, the White House is downplaying a new federal report that says the U.S. economy will be damaged by climate change. There's a major effort to rescue manatees from the red tide in Florida, and more on This Week in Water.
Chicago could have weather like Phoenix. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. economy will be damaged by climate change as its effects lead to bigger and more destructive wildfires, droughts, and heat waves, according to a new report from the federal government.
The U.S. Global Change Research Program released its fourth national climate assessment the day after Thanksgiving, and its conclusions are not surprising given the recent U.N. report warning that we need to keep average global temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius.
But what is surprising? The 1,600-page report comes from the Trump administration, some of whom, including the president, continue not to recognize the dangers of global warming.
The report gets into specifics. For example, in the American West, as it gets warmer, the change in the amount and timing of precipitation won't match the demand for water.
According to Inside Climate News, Chicago's climate could become more like Phoenix, with temps reaching 100 degrees Fahrenheit on many summer days.
In some areas, drying farmlands will lead to crop failures, and the geographic range of diseases like Lyme, West Nile, and Zika will expand.
The report also says that flooding from heavy rainfall, storm surges, and rising high tides are expected to compound existing issues with aging infrastructure in the Northeast. East.
Trump downplayed the assessment, saying it was largely based upon the most extreme scenario. However, Catherine Hayhoe, one of the report's authors, told The Guardian that the White House's position is demonstrably false. All scenarios were considered, not just the most extreme.
Many of the people who are migrating north from Guatemala and other areas of Central America are fleeing violence and gangs, but there are additional reasons they leave their homes. Some migrants are also motivated by hunger caused by lean harvests and drought.
That was the conclusion of the Department of Homeland Security back in September, and since then, The Guardian has reported that climate change was a driving factor of those problems. And according to Tomasz Topinski of the University of Cincinnati, there's another cause in the mix, deforestation.
Deforestation can lead to food insecurity because it degrades natural habitats on which people depend for their food, livelihoods, and fuel.
Stepinski, a professor of geography, has created a new world map showing dramatic land use changes over the last 25 years. Guatemala has seen widespread deforestation, with much of the forest being used for firewood.
Stepinski's maps show that more than one-fifth of the earth was altered between 1992 and 2015, primarily from forest to agriculture.
His new world maps show changes not only in forests, but also in wetlands, farmlands, and reservoirs.
A group of fishing enterprises on the West Coast filed suit last week against 30 fossil fuel companies seeking compensation for losses due to climate change.
Crabbers say they're suffering because some of their fishing waters have been closed due to algae blooms in the warming Pacific Ocean. They claim that both the quantity and safety of crabs are affected.
The warming water causes algae blooms that lead to a buildup in shellfish of a potent human neurotoxin. California officials recently issued warnings not to eat internal parts of Dungeness crab from certain areas due to the toxin.
Inside Climate News reports that the lawsuit brought by the crabbers is unusual because it pits one industry against another. Some municipalities have already sued oil and gas companies, but this is the first time businesses have done so.
On the other coast, algae is still affecting wildlife in Florida. Manatees are large mammals that typically live in coastal or river waters in North America, Africa, and the Amazon. Those that are in Florida have suffered greatly from the red tide algae blooms that began about a year ago.
The animals absorb a toxin from the algae through their skin, inhale it when they breathe, and ingest it by eating plants that have algae on them. Efforts by zoos, aquariums, and marine parks like SeaWorld to save the manatees are challenging due to their size.
John Peterson, the rescue manager at SeaWorld, told The Guardian that in the summer they had to search their warehouses to find portable pools for dozens of manatees that were arriving two or three a week.
Peterson even paid the airfare to send some manatees to zoos in Ohio so there would be more space at his rehab facility. SeaWorld alone has taken in 66 manatees this year. And finally this week, we turn to earwax. Not the human kind that builds up in our ear canals, but what accumulates in a whale's ears. They too excrete wax, and as it turns out, it's a great tool for scientists because the animal's so-called earplugs stay with them for life.
For that reason, a whale's earplug can reveal an animal's age, similar to tree rings, because as the creatures alternate between summer feeding and winter migrations, the wax in their ears changes from light to dark.
And the wax can also help scientists analyze what the whales were experiencing when each band was formed. According to a recent study from Baylor University, they've been under a lot of stress.
Using earplugs taken from fin, humpback, and blue whales that lived in the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans from 1870 to 2016, researchers found that the whales' cortisol levels correlated to whether the creatures were being hunted. During the 1960s, when whaling was at its height, cortisol peaked to a maximum, and when whaling moratoriums were introduced in the mid-1970s, cortisol levels dropped dramatically.
Whales were also stressed during World War II, despite a decline in whaling, and the authors surmise it was likely due to wartime activities, such as underwater detonation, naval battles, as well as plane and submarine noise.
In recent decades, stress levels have been starting to climb again, due to climate change. According to National Geographic, topic, scientists are still trying to understand how global warming causes stress. But increased temperatures could be altering the location and abundance of food sources, and just being in hot water is probably not conducive to a whale's health.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for preference. Then at 7, it's Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will again be rain with a high of 51 degrees. Today in history, in 1942, Jimi Hendrix was born in Seattle, Washington. Jimi Hendrix is widely regarded as one of the most influential and innovative electric guitarists and one of the most celebrated musicians of the 20th century. The quote of the day is from Jimi Hendrix, who said, quote, "When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace." Now it's time for the Middle East Minute Plus. On today's episode, the National Students for Justice in Palestine and the Palestinian Youth Movement issue a joint statement on the institutional opposition faced last week during the NSJP conference at UCLA.
I'm Esti Chandler for the Middle East Minute Plus. National Students for Justice in Palestine, or NSJP, and the Palestinian Youth Movement, or PYM, issued a statement on the institutional opposition the NSJP conference faced last week at UCLA. The yearly gathering of students from the over 200 Students for Justice in Palestine chapters across the country features workshops, expert speakers, and a cultural event. The statement, titled "NSJP and PYM Condemn Repression, Racism, and Islamophobia During NSJP Conference at UCLA," is co-sponsored by a growing list of leading Palestinian and solidarity organizations. The detailed account makes clear that what happened leading up to and during the NSJP conference was, quote, "the result of the complete normalization of Islamophobic, anti-Arab, and anti-Black sentiments and assumptions. Dehumanizing language breeds dehumanizing acts. As such, every official who made such statements played into the larger cycle that often included the threat of physical violence or even worse, befalling attendees, and bears a marked responsibility for the danger we all faced this weekend," end quote. Officials linked to harmful statements and actions include the entire LA City Council, led by Councilman Paul Koretz, Mayor Eric Garcetti, and Congressman Brad Sherman. As exposed in Al Jazeera's censored documentary, The Lobby USA, the efforts to stop the NSJP conference from taking place and the demonstrations held during the conference, which included Israeli military reservists being brought to UCLA along with militant off-campus groups to intimidate students, can directly be linked back to the Israeli government's longtime and many-pronged project of astroturfing pro-Israel activism in the U.S. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Rescue searchers have been combing the remains of more than 14,000 homes that comprise the city of Paradise over the last 2 weeks. Officials say that a good portion of the city has already been searched. However, the task of identifying the victims has been exceedingly difficult, as most of the remains are no more than bones or fragments. There are still 203 people missing from the region. And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, a Yukon First Nation leader says a pilot project has improved public safety. TransCanada will ask federal court to allow work on the Keystone XL pipeline, and the trial will begin for the former Omaha officer involved in the death of a Native man.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A First Nation leader says long-term funding is needed to help address violence and promote healing in Indigenous communities in areas of public safety, wellness, and child welfare programs. As the Canadian government gathers testimony on murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. At a hearing in Calgary Monday, Chief Doris Bill of the Kwanlindun First Nation says services need to be culturally and community-based.
Cultural continuity must be rebuilt on the foundation of our powerful stories, language, teachings, and the practices of our ancestors. Our best solution for healing are found in our communities. A person cannot invest in their own well-being and that of others if they are in constant fear of harm.
Bill says in recent years, her community, which is located in the Yukon Territory, has made a significant impact in improving safety through a pilot project. She says the Community Safety Officer Program helps prevent trauma and works with the wellness team by mediating disputes, providing rides to people in risky situations, and calls upon law enforcement and other service providers when needed. The officers have built trust within the community, says Bill, which has decreased crime, including prostitution and bootlegging. She says when they developed the program, they had to take a hard look at what was happening.
The CSO program was developed in direct response to community members' concerns in public meetings that they were feeling unsafe in their homes and in the community. We heard of women sleeping with baseball bats by their beds. Entire families were sleeping in their basements because they were scared to go outside or sleep upstairs.
Bill says they're pursuing funding options to maintain the program. Commissioners in Canada's National Investigation into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls is holding hearings in Calgary this week and heading to Ottawa in December. TransCanada is asking a federal court in Montana to allow work to continue on the Keystone XL pipeline. Earlier this month, an order by Judge Brian Morris stalled the project, ruling the Trump administration relied on outdated information when it overturned the Obama administration's decision to deny the pipeline a permit, noting thousands of acres still have to be surveyed for environmental and cultural impacts. The Associated Press reports the company is asking the judge to allow pre-construction to continue. A telephone conference is planned for Wednesday. Tribal and environmental groups applauded the project's delay. Tribes say there needs to be government-to-government consultation on the project. In Nebraska, the trial is expected to begin this week for former Omaha police officer Scotty Payne for his connection to the death of Zachary Bearheels. Bearheels died in June 2017 while in police custody after being shocked with a taser and punched more than a dozen times. The Native community has since called for justice. The Omaha World Herald reports Payne is one of the first Omaha police officers to face criminal charges out of a grand jury investigation. In the late 1990s and 2000, two Omaha police officers involved in deadly incidents initially faced charges but were later dismissed. Bearheels, who was mentally ill, was said to be traveling between South Dakota and Oklahoma when he was kicked off a bus and spent hours wandering Omaha streets before the officer-involved incident took place after a convenience store employee called police. A second former Omaha police officer is awaiting trial for his part. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Portland Public School Board has released its new proposed policy on professional conduct, but not everyone is happy. The six-page document is the result of a promise made by the school board to adopt a policy of conduct after it was revealed in October of 2017 that the district ignored complaints about teacher and coach Mitch Whitehurst for several years over sexual misconduct. The document details how teachers, staff, and volunteers should conduct themselves when interacting with students both on and off school grounds, as well as in interactions via social media. However, leaders of the Portland Association of Teachers are not happy with the policy as it is written. They complain that it is vague in some areas and hard to apply. The association also said that it could place normal teacher-student interactions in a gray area. The union demanded that the district negotiate the policy with them last month. This puts the vote by the board on the matter on hold for 90 days from when the union made its demand. General Motors has announced that it will be closing five automobile manufacturing plants and laying off more than 14,000 workers. GM said the plant closures will save the company over $6 billion in costs yearly. In a statement announcing the closures, GM Chairman and CEO Mary Barra said, quote, "We recognize the need to stay in front of changing market conditions. Among those changing conditions are a drop in sales of U.S. manufactured vehicles and the rising cost of needed raw materials due to new tariffs on imported steel and aluminum." Earlier this year, Ford Motor Company announced a reorganization plan that would cut close to 24,000 jobs and also cited the new tariffs as a contributing factor, saying that the tariffs had cost the company over $1 billion. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 27th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu and Al Khan. Our producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul welcomes climate change activist George Bratta to talk about the UK protest movement known as Extinction Rebellion. At 9, the radio activist talks to members of NWGSD about their work advocating for social, financial, and environmental justice. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the Recovery Zone introduces Oregon Walks and their efforts to bring transportation justice to our streets. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News. And today on Sojourner Truth, an update on attacks on migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. On Sunday, November 25th, U.S. officials fired tear gas at migrants, including women and children attempting to breach the U.S.-Mexico border. Gas canisters and pepper balls were also used, leaving children gasping for breath and traumatized. Trump strongly defended the use of the gas. Indeed, he lied, saying several Border Patrol agents were badly injured by the migrants. Tear gas is considered a chemical weapon under international law. Our guests are David Abud with Pueblo Sin Fronteras, who is currently at the U.S.-Mexico border, and Pedro Rios, director of the U.S.-Mexico Border Program at the American Friends Service Committee.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. On Sunday, November 25th, U.S. officials fired tear gas at migrants along the U.S.-Mexico border, including women and children who were attempting to breach the U.S.-Mexico border. Gas canisters and pepper balls were also used, leaving children gasping for breath and traumatized. Donald Trump strongly defended the use of gas. Indeed, he lied, saying several Border Patrol agents were badly injured by the migrants. That's not true. Meanwhile, tear gas is considered a chemical weapon under international law. Our guest is Pedro Reyes, the director of the U.S.-Mexico Border Program at the American Friends Service Committee, and an uprising in Haiti as protesters continue to hit the streets calling for the ouster of U.S.-elected and backed President Jovenel Moise, as well as calling for accountability for the disappearance of over $1 billion stolen by government officials. That money was part of a Petrocaribe plan of aid from Venezuela. Pierre Lebossier is our guest. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The special counsel on the Russia investigation is accusing former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort of violating his plea agreement by repeatedly lying to federal investigators. The allegation could expose him to a lengthier prison sentence and potentially more criminal charges. The torpedoing of Manafort's plea deal, disclosed in a court filing Monday, also results in special counsel Robert Mueller's team losing a cooperating witness from the top of President Trump's presidential campaign, who was present for several key episodes under investigation. That includes a Trump Tower meeting involving Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian lawyer he was told had derogatory information on Democrat Hillary Clinton. In the latest filing, Mueller's team said Manafort committed federal crimes by lying about a variety of subject matters even after he agreed to truthfully cooperate with the investigation. Prosecutors said they will detail the nature of the defendant's crimes and lies in writing at a later date to the judge. Manafort's attorneys denied the allegations and said he has been cooperating. Mississippi voters are voting in a runoff election today to decide a Senate race. Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith is squaring off against Democrat Mike Espy. Mississippi's past of racist violence has become a dominant theme after a video showed Hyde-Smith, who is white, praising a supporter in early November by saying, quote, "If he invited me to a public hanging, I'd be on the front row," unquote. Hyde-Smith said it was an exaggerated expression of regard. She eventually apologized for the remark. If Espy wins, he would be the first black senator from the state since Reconstruction. Hyde-Smith was seen in another video talking about making voting difficult for, quote, liberal folks, and a photo circulated of her wearing a replica Confederate military hat during a 2014 visit to a museum in Biloxi, Mississippi. That was the last home of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. President Trump held a rally in the state Monday to support her.
We need the people of Mississippi to go to the polls and elect Sidney Hyde-Smith so that we can continue doing what we're doing, which is frankly unprecedented. What's happening is unprecedented. Look, what's the simple two words? It's called America First.
Smith's words and actions have prompted some corporate donors, including Walmart, to request refunds on the campaign contributions to her. The NAACP website says that between 1882 and 1968, Mississippi had 581 lynchings, the highest of any other state. Bay Area civil rights leaders are calling for a boycott of the San Francisco Giants baseball team. They say Giants co-owner Charles Johnson donated thousands of dollars to the Senate campaign of Republican Cindy Hyde-Smith, who said she would attend a public hanging if one of her supporters were staging it. The remark has evoked memories of Mississippi's history of lynching African Americans. Christopher Martinez has more.
Hyde-Smith has called her comments a joke taken out of context. The team has issued a statement saying it does not condone any racist and hateful language. A lawyer for Charles Johnson says he does not know Hyde-Smith and was not aware of her comments about public hanging when he made his donation. But that does not mollify critics. Reverend Amos Brown is president of the San Francisco chapter of the NAACP.
We have a moral obligation to not support the Giants so that people may go to the Giants game and enjoy themselves at our expense.
In Mississippi, Hyde-Smith is getting support from President Donald Trump, who was scheduled to speak at two campaign rallies for the Republican. Her Democratic opponent, Mike Espy, is running to become the first black senator from Mississippi since Reconstruction. However that race turns out, the controversy will likely carry on. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
An Ohio man charged with killing a woman during a white nationalist rally in Virginia plans to argue that he believed he was acting in self-defense when he drove his car into a crowd of counter-demonstrators. A lawyer for James Alex Fields offered a glimpse of the defense strategy as jury selection began Monday in Charlottesville, 15 months after the city became a flashpoint for race relations in the U.S. The Unite the Right rally on August 12th of last year drew hundreds of white nationalists to Charlottesville, where officials planned to remove a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Hundreds more showed up to protest against the white nationalists. The two sides eventually clashed. Heather Heyer was killed when a car authorities say was driven by Fields plowed into a crowd of protesters. The European Union's highest court today began considering whether Britain can change its mind about leaving the EU. But that's not the position of British Prime Minister Theresa May, who is struggling to convince Parliament to back her Brexit plan. May told Parliament that her deal is the best possible agreement for both the UK and the EU.
I do not pretend that either we or the EU are entirely happy with these arrangements, and that's how it must be. Were either party entirely happy, that party would have no incentive to move on to the future relationship.
The Brexit session opened by the European Court of Justice will assess the issue under an accelerated procedure since Britain is due to leave the bloc on March 29th. Since Article 50 of the EU Treaty of Lisbon dealing with the departing members is scant on details, because it was expected that no EU nation would want to leave, a group of Scottish legislators wants to know whether the UK can pull out of the withdrawal procedure on its own. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Subscribe for a free podcast. You can also check out our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. We are also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott on SoundCloud. And today we would like to give a shout out to all of our SoundCloud listeners, South of the border. And in the United States, we'd like to give a shout out to all of our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Mississippi, where an election will be happening to choose a senator from Mississippi. We are now going to turn our attention to the crisis happening now at the border. On Sunday, November 25th, Donald Trump's administration began its direct physical repression against Central American migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum, firing tear gas and gas canisters at migrants, including women with their children who were attempting to cross the border. Tear gas is considered, by the way, a chemical weapon under international law. Now, we're going to find out what is going on from our two guests. Before that, let us just hear a short clip from AP of a reporter recounting the tear gas incident.
The gas was blowing with the breeze in the same direction, the only direction that the migrants could run. There were parents clutching young children in their arms, trying to run as fast as they could. It was difficult to see because eyes were watering, your nose was running, it was mucus flowing out of your mouth. People were coughing, children were coughing, choking on the gas. Some women were passing their children to men who could try to run faster to get out of the gas. People were begging anyone for some water to pour over their children's eyes. It was a scary moment because it was difficult to get out of the gas the way it was blowing, and you couldn't really see where you were going. So yesterday, several hundred migrants from here at the shelter in Tijuana marched toward the border, what was supposed to be a peaceful demonstration, and largely was a peaceful demonstration for much of the morning. When they arrived to a bridge that leads to the Mexican port of entry, there were federal police with shields and helmets blocking their way. All the while, a Customs and Border Protection helicopter was hovering over the area. Several dozen migrants began to go down to the center of that earthen levee where there was a small gap. A few of them managed to open a small space in the wire. A woman told me this morning that she saw several people get through. Some were trying to pass children through. And that's when agents on the U.S. side fired tear gas into Mexico.
Oh, my goodness. I'd like to welcome our guest, David Abud, a member of Pueblos Sin Fronteras, currently at the U.S.-Mexico border assisting Central American migrants. David, thank you for joining us. David, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you. Sorry
okay,
about that.
That's quite all right. Also, I'd like to welcome Pedro Reyes, director of the U.S.-Mexico Border Program at the American Friends Service Committee. Pedro, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret, for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so David, let's just start with you. What is the situation now at the border? We know there's a lot of confusion. Some migrants choosing to return back to Honduras, some are reporting, but for the most part, people staying in these vast tent cities. David, what is the situation?
Yeah, well, I think the overall situation right now is one of increasing desperation. People have been put into this as you mentioned, an open air shelter that is increasingly becoming, the conditions are increasingly becoming more and more miserable. It was meant for 3,600 people. There's now over 5,000, probably close to 6,000 people that are staying there. There's very little information that is getting to people. There's very little options for people to take one of the more visible options that has been facilitated in the past couple days has been an effort to voluntarily deport people back to their country of origin. So that's also something that you're starting to see. But the vast majority of people are fleeing conditions of extreme violence, poverty, economic and political and social instability. And so people are still willing to stay here, even though the conditions continue to deteriorate. And, they're facing attacks by the U.S. government. They're facing attacks from the local right-wing government here in Tijuana. There is very little effort from the federal government to help because there's a new government that's going to be taking power on December 1st. Because of the particular political and economic interests that people have that governments have around this, there's been very little response from the UN and from international actors actually declaring this a refugee crisis. So it's also not the first time that this has happened in Tijuana, right? It's not the first time the 10,000 migrants and refugees have shown up to Tijuana asking for asylum in the U.S. This happened a couple years ago when there was a crisis with Haitian refugees that were coming. But it's something that, it's a continued cycle of this. And this time it's even more politicized because the way that people chose to come here for safety was through this caravan, right? What they're calling an exodus. So it's far more politicized now than it ever was. But the climate continues to be one of increasing desperation.
Right. And Pedro, before we go to you, let's just hear some more information, including Donald Trump defending what's going on.
Breaking news, Mexico tonight demanding the United States investigate the use of tear gas on migrants who rushed the U.S. border. This as President Trump is denying that children were on the receiving end.
We don't use it.
Now, according to Reuters, these pictures, they took, tell a different story. You see children crying. According to Reuters, they're running away from tear gas thrown by U.S. Border Patrol agents. Miguel Marquez is out front with more from the Mexican side of the southern border.
Desperation turns to anger as migrants overwhelm Mexican police and storm the U.S. border. Hundreds of migrants, part of the caravan of Central Americans who have been moving north for weeks, that first protested, then grew more aggressive. The president saying the situation called for the use of force.
They had to use because they were being rushed by some very tough people, and they used tear gas. And here's the bottom line. Nobody's coming into our country unless they come in legally.
The U.S. Border Patrol says four of its officers outfitted in riot gear were hit with rocks but were not injured. They deployed tear gas and shot pepper balls to disperse the crowd. Video captured the migrants as they ran toward the border, then fanned out along it looking for any weak point. Caught up in the melee, women and children. One photo shows a mother dragging her children away from the conflict and smoke, one of her kids in diapers. In a tweet, the president called many of the migrants stone-cold criminals and used the episode to push his agenda, writing, "We will close the border permanently if need be. Congress, fund the wall." At issue, whether thousands of migrants who caravan from Central America seeking asylum will ever be allowed the opportunity to have it. The number of asylum applications at legal border crossings has diminished to a trickle. The protest and border confrontation won't help their cause.
If they were truly asylum seekers, they would have just walked up with their hands up and surrendered, and that did not take place.
Dozens were arrested on the U.S. and Mexican sides of the border. U.S. officials say those arrested will be allowed to make an asylum plea and be prosecuted for any crimes they may have committed. Mexican authorities say law-breaking migrants will be deported to their home countries.
All right, and that's a clip from CNN. So Pedro, David is still with us, but Pedro Reyes bringing you into this discussion, director of the U.S.-Mexico Border Program at the American Friends Service Committee. So there you go, U.S. tax dollars being used, troops at the border shooting gas canisters and tear gas at migrants, including women and children. Just your response to this and some of what people on this side of the border are doing to support the migrants. Pedro Reyes.
Yeah, so how I would qualify was an unwarranted show of force by the Border Patrol. The Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection, which is its parent agency, and the Office of Field Operations responded aggressively to a situation that didn't merit that sort of response. They also shut down the San Isidro Land Port of Entry, which is the world's heaviest land crossing, with over 120,000, 130,000 people crossing daily. The community of San Isidro estimates that there were an estimated of $5.3 million that were lost in businesses. Many of the businesses in that specific community rely specifically on this season to make most of their year's gains. Tijuana lost approximately $6 million in revenue as well because of the shutdown of the border. And so essentially what is taking place is this is a crisis that the Trump administration has been manufacturing in order to justify funding for the border wall, as we're getting closer to the debate around the budget that ends on December 7th. Trump is looking for ways of ensuring support for monies that will go for his vanity wall, and unfortunately, this is going to be a situation that he is going to exploit, and that precisely Border Patrol agents firing gas canisters over 20 detonations we heard and we documented. Very aggressive a flyover by a helicopter that was using its rotors to push the cloud of smoke into the canal where children were at, and that very dangerous way of using these sort of chemical weapons. And so we, as the American Friends Service Committee, we condemn these actions. We take issue with the militarization of the border. We think that both the U.S. and Mexican authorities had sufficient time to prepare for the humane treatment and the humane processing of those who are traveling so many miles for survival, really, to make a claim for asylum. And so this crisis has been manufactured for the purpose of the political theater that is going on in Washington. And it's unfortunate that both border communities are suffering these sorts of losses and trampling of rights in our communities, as well as migrants who are at the crosshairs of militarization.
Yeah, now, Pedro, apparently from what I gather, there is going to be a peaceful protest by several religious denominations, participants by faith leaders, I should say faith leaders, that's coming up that you have been involved in. Tell us about that, when it will take place, and who will be participating.
That's correct. So we are calling for 100 faith leaders to gather at the border for a direct action on December 10th. And December 10th is the International Human Rights Day. And faith leaders carry the moral authority. So the idea is that they're calling to question the morality of the decisions that this administration has been making in its treatment of migrants and refugees. And it'll be the launch of a week-long set of activities. We're hoping that communities across the country will organize echo actions and solidarity events from December 10th ending on December 18th, which is International Migrants Day, in order to lift up
the call for the fair and humane treatment of migrants, for the demilitarization of border communities, and for the end of deportation and detention for migrants who are finding themselves in our country.
Right, and thank you for that, Pedro Rios. And David Abood, bringing you back into this discussion here, in terms of any, you know, assistance from this side of the border to the migrants, I mean, is it possible? Well, I guess if with the shutting of the border, it makes it very difficult. But I don't know if there are some of your equivalent, you know, on the ground in Tijuana or anywhere else along the U.S.-Mexico border that can, you know, offer some assistance to the migrants. David Abood.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ways in which people can do that. There's a number of fundraisers. If you go to the Facebook page of Pueblos y Fronteras, there's a fundraiser there. There's a number of other there's a number of other organizations that people can be donating to, and we'll be putting up those fundraising links up on there. But also it's donations that people can bring of food, of clothing, of garbage bags, like water, anything like that. That any of those kind of necessities that people might need. Are always welcome. Can I just say something else also about
sure.
in response to the reporting by CNN? I was there at the border, 10 feet from the border, when those tear gas canisters started being thrown, and I had to take a little 5-year-old girl. I had to go into the tear gas, grab this 5-year-old girl, and run probably at least 200 yards because the smoke was flowing through the canal in our direction and was coughing and my eyes were running. I could barely breathe, and I had to rinse this little girl's face off and hand her back to her mom. There's so much political propaganda that's coming from this administration, saying that those were tough people that were there. First of all, those mothers and 5-year-old children, and even the men that were there, none of them are hardened criminals, tough people. Just the whole narrative about people rushing the border. There was a small group that attempted to climb over the border. Our group, the vast majority of people, were right up to the border, but were kind of just milling around there, seeing that there was barbed wire fence. There wasn't really a way for people to get through. And that's when tear gas canisters started being thrown at us without any provocation from our side, without any rocks being thrown. And furthermore, you know, these are the things that people had come there really with the idea that they would be able to cross into the U.S. There's all this narrative about that people have to present themselves at the port of entry, that they would come surrender themselves willingly. There is no way for people to surrender themselves willingly. The U.S.
Yeah.
has created an illegal list there's still 2,000 people in front of the first caravan members in order just to present themselves for asylum. And so all of these are, you know, these are violations of the 1951 Refugee Convention that the U.S. is a party to. They're in violation of international law, of the U.S. law, and especially, you know, it's also a violation of Mexico's sovereignty to be throwing throwing chemical weapons into Mexican territory, which some of those smoke grenades came into the Playa Tijuana Highway, which is one of the heaviest, most heavily transited highways in Tijuana, and that highway had to be closed because of that. So really, when people are talking about hardened criminals, when people are talking about illegality, all of that is happening on the U.S. government side, and they're forcing people into not having any other option, right? People can't present themselves legally at the border, so people have to try to find another way in order to actually be able to exercise their right under international law to seek asylum. One of the things that the reporting did get right is that all of these asylum claims have slowed to a trickle. That's a political act that's done on purpose on behalf of the U.S. government. And they're being squeezed here by the local right-wing government, right?
Yeah.
They're being squeezed here by the conditions in the shelter, right? To me, it's appalling how many people believe this, but to me, this is also not shocking. This is what the U.S. is about in 2018. It is about tear gassing children and
yeah, and taking children from their parents, literally kidnapping exactly. children. We are practically out of time here, Pedro and David. For people who want to support the efforts of Pueblos Sin Fronteras, what should they do?
They can get in contact with us on our Facebook page, and we can, if they're in the border region, we can guide them to the proper ways if they want to come down here and support. Really what we're asking for is legal support, communication support with media to dispel a lot of the disinformation that is happening.
Okay.
If there's volunteers that can come and support with security. But otherwise, it's just supporting with donations and bringing materials down here. We'll have a list up on the Pueblos Sin Fronteras page, and there's also a number of fundraisers that we'll be putting up on there for people for legal support as well as for material support.
Right,
down here.
And we'll post that information and have you back. Please continue to update us on what's going on so that we can help to get the word out. I'd like to thank you, David Abud and Pedro Rios, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. We are out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our team, our board op today, Teddy Robinson, our intern, Julianne Tweeten, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. Romero, we wish you good health and hope you get better very, very soon. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Brew for the SLU, Columbia SLU Watershed Council Give Guide Party on Thursday, December 13th, 4 to 8 p.m. at the Alberta Street Pub in Portland. This event features food, drink, live music, fortune-telling, and more. The Columbia SLU Watershed Council works to clean up the Columbia SLU. They teach environmental education in schools, engage volunteers to plant trees, and nature festivals. Again, that's Brew for the SLU, Columbia SLU Watershed Council Give Guide Party on Thursday.